only man I ever met who could actually lift it and swing it with enough force to do any damage. Anise laughed at that.
Aye, I saw him nearly win a tourney using it.
Nearly? Fay said. You mean he was defeated?
Hard to believe, I know, but it just so happens we have the best swordsman in the realm commanding the First Cavalry. Sir Dietrich. He emerged the victor.
Ah, I've heard of him. But still.
I watched Choose win a dozen tourneys. When I was with him, he never lost.
With him? What exactly did that mean?
Choose? His name is Terin.
Oh, she said.
He told us to call him Choose.
I have had many names, Terin said, interrupting. But now I go by the one my mother gave me, Terin.
Well, Fay said, it's a pleasure to finally meet you, Terin.
Did you design his armour as well?
Anise guessed.
Yes, and I'm glad to see the big guy has kept it in good nick. Though it's looking a bit small these days. Once we make camp, I can work on the fit.
So it's not just my imagination. He is getting larger.
He rarely takes it off, Anise said. Even to sleep. Though last night...
You mean he's still self-conscious about his affliction? Fay asked. Anise was taken aback. This woman knew what he looked like beneath the armour.
Of course you would know, she said. You fitted his armour.
Fay laughed.
I wouldn't say I know. He never let me see him. But I saw enough.
Anise breathed easier. She liked this woman. Her quick tongue, her skill with the hammer, the strength in her body. And if she hadn't seen what Terin really looked like, there had been nothing between them worth worrying about.
Enough about me, Terin said, sounding uncomfortable. Where have you been all these years?
Around, Fay said.
With Bart?
Who's Bart? Anise asked. It was strange thinking about Terin having a past, a space in between the years that she had known him. Though he told her some of what had happened to him, there were probably thousands of details he'd left out. People like Fay and Bart, who must have been important to him in various ways.
A money-grubbing little weas...
Fay started to say, but Terin cut her off.
My first and only tourney sponsor, he said.
I haven't seen him in many years, Fay said. But he was a scoundrel anyway.
Yes, he liked his coin, Terin said. And he helped me for all the wrong reasons. But still, I owe him a lot. I owe both of you.
Fay blinked. Though she tried to hide her feelings, Anise could sense the pride there.
Like I told you before we parted ways, Fay said.
I know, I know. You were just doing your job. But still, thank you for my armour, for the Morning Star.
And now you want to forge smaller versions of Terran's weapon?
Anise asked, bringing the conversation full circle. Fay shrugged.
I don't know. Perhaps. It's just something I've been playing around with. The weapon loses a lot of its power when made smaller, but a normal soldier can't wield it otherwise.
Are you saying I'm not normal? Terin asked.
Anise was pleased to hear that the lightness in his tone had returned.
A man-beast like you, Fay said. Perfectly normal. You'd fit right in with the ice bears of the hinterlands.
Anise laughed.
That's what I'm always telling him.
Fay smiled.
In any case, it was lovely meeting you, Your Highness, and a pleasant surprise seeing you again, Terin. I won't take up any more of your time.
I want to know everything about the time after you left Castle Hill, Anise said, as they rode back up the line toward the front of the slow-moving train. Terin grunted.
The past is the past. We should leave it there.
I don't like not knowing things about you.
I thought you were attracted to me because I was mysterious.
About as mysterious as a tin can, Anise said,
Wrapping her knuckles on his armour. His hand grabbed hers and he held on, riding together for a spell.
Seriously, though, your past isn't a mystery to those who were there with you, so why should it be to me?
You have much more important things to set your mind to,
an excuse.
I have a deal for you. If we retake Castle Hill, I'll tell you the whole story. Every single detail.
Anise considered it. She could keep pressing him for more information now, but he'd probably only pull his head further into his armor, like a turtle hiding from a predator. It was the best she was going to get.
Deal, she said.
The train rode on another 5 days without seeing another of Lord Griswold's monsters. Each day Anise and Terrin rode the line, getting to know the soldiers, trading quips, learning their names. She was surprised how much she enjoyed it, how good she was at it. She'd always thought of Archer as the charismatic one in the family, but perhaps some of his charm had rubbed off on her along the way. Or maybe it had been hiding inside her the whole time, just waiting to come out. She always made a point to stop at Faye's cart to chat for a few moments. Evidently, while they camped each night, the blacksmith set up a makeshift forge and continued working on what she was calling her Evenstar design, the miniature versions of Terrin's larger Morningstar. Today, on the 5th day since Anise had met her, Faye had a sample ready. She handed Anise the handle, and she gripped it tightly, relishing the supple leather binding. Even the sample was of exquisite workmanship.
"Can I swing it?"
Anise asked.
Faye shrugged.
"Why not? This one is for testing, and I've heard you are a strong woman."
Terrin said, "Perhaps we should let someone else test it before the Queen. Let me."
"Is he always like this around you?"
Faye asked.
"He used to be worse," Anise said. "And then I beat off an ice bear. Now back off, Sir Worrywart!"
With a mighty heave, she swung the modified mace overhead. Terrin ducked as the Evenstar whipped past. Anise let out a whoop of delight as she cut a round arc in the sky, the spiked ball whizzing past like a red star. She became more daring, altering her swing to a figure eight, and then a quick snap like a whip, the ball flinging outwards at an imaginary foe. She lost her grip. The Evenstar, chain and all, flew through the air, crashing into the side of a cart bearing half a dozen seamstresses darning thick socks, who screamed at the impact. As Anise watched in horror, the heavy spiked ball splintered the wood, ripping a plank from the bottom of the platform. The two horses pulling the cart spooked, rearing back and almost toppling backwards. Anise leapt from her mount and raced over, apologies already on her lips.
"Are you hurt?"
she asked the women, who looked more startled than anything. After checking themselves, they all confirmed they were fine. Anise offered them the day off, but they politely declined. Terrin opened his mouth to say something, but Anise stopped him with a single word.
"Don't." "I was only going to say it was a nice shot," he said, chuckling,
once they were riding next to Faye's cart once more. Sheepishly, Anise handed her the Evenstar.
"I could have killed someone."
"But you didn't, and you will learn from the mistake."
"Learn?"
"Yes, for the next time."
"Next time?"
"Yes," Faye said, cutting in.
"I want you to have the first one. I think it's the perfect weapon for you."
Shocked, Anise accepted the Evenstar back, though she was almost afraid to touch it. She swore it had practically jumped out of her hand the last time.
I don't know. I'm usually better with my fists."
"And snowballs,"
Terrin reminded her.
"I never thought of the Evenstar's potential as a projectile,"
Faye said.
"You demonstrated that very well." "It was an accident." "Some of the best inventions are discovered by accident,"
Faye said. Anise wasn't certain whether she was just trying to make her feel better, but she did like the feel of that leather grip.
"Then I guess there's nothing left to say but thank you."
"You are most welcome, Your Highness."
Anise held up the weapon toward Terrin.
"Now we match."
Terrin only shook his head. They halted the procession 2 days later, not at night, but midday, because they could see it. Castle Hill, its white walls and ramparts shining in the sunlight through the swirling snow like a beacon.
"Home,"
Anise thought. It felt like a lifetime since she'd been forced to flee with Arch through the sewer tunnels. Then she had wondered whether she would ever return to the city she grew up in. At the time, she hadn't cared. She'd hated the city, what it represented. She'd longed to leave its bounds and never return. But now... Now she was shocked at how much she'd missed it. Terin said,
"It's more beautiful than I remembered."
Anise nodded. She knew the feeling. "I think it was my father that made it so ugly," she said.
"It seems your uncle is trying to carry on the tradition."
Anise narrowed her eyes, staring at the high, thick walls, wondering what monsters lurked behind them. "It's time for this tradition to change. Gather the cavalry, commanders. We attack tomorrow at first light." 27. The Western Kingdom, the Dead Isles. Grey Aris. When Grey's small craft collided with the shoreline, he tried to jam one of his oars between the jagged rocks to hold himself steady. For a moment it worked, and his boat held firm. But then a wave crushed him from behind, twisting the boat around and throwing him off balance. His arms windmilled several times as he lost the oar, which continued to stick from the rocks like an oversized pin from a cushion. And then, when another wave swept in on a strange angle, his vessel capsized. Black, churning waters closed in around his head, punching him with an icy fist and trying to claw inside his mouth. He came up sputtering, frantically kicking both legs and waving both his hand and his stub. His head cracked against something hard, and he tried to make sense of the darkness that surrounded him. The boat. He was inside the boat, which was upside down. Waves continued to bash into the wooden sides, which then threatened to break him in half. He needed to get away from his vessel or he would die. Taking a deep breath that was as much salty seawater as air, Grey dove, kicking hard and trying to put distance between himself and the boat, which scraped past, borne on the swift current. When he resurfaced, his boat was gone, and he was faced with a greater danger, the shard-like rocks that seemed to want to impale him on their hardened spikes. A wave picked him up, carrying him toward the rocks at far too great a speed. He cried out, but his scream was lost amongst the crashing of the waves on the shore. His shoulder slammed against a black rock, shooting agony through the very marrow of his bones, and he tried to hang on, but the stones were slick with wet moss and his only hand slid away. The ocean inhaled, sucking him back out to sea. His shoulder throbbed. His knee ached, too, where he must have hit it on the rocks. His lungs heaved, burning with swallowed salt water. The ocean's next breath was a great sigh, in unison with his own, sending him back toward the black sledgehammer that would crush him into human paste. And then he saw it, the oar, still protruding from the rocks. He reached for it, grunting, a zing of fear and thrill sparking inside his gut. His fingers closed around the wooden shaft, even as his body was smashed like a doll slung against a wall by a tantrum-throwing child. The world flipped, but still he clutched the oar, refusing to let go. He tried to shield his head with his stub and his arm, which took the brunt of the blow. His legs twisted and he felt something pop, but still he hung on. The ocean retreated and still he hung on. The oar creaked and bounced, and still he hung on. And then, as a fine rain began to fall through the mist, he started to climb, scrabbling at the wet rock and fighting for every inch, until he flopped, much like a beached fish, onto the unforgiving shore, panting and crying and laughing. "Shay, I'm coming. I'm here." The wind blew a forlorn reply, chilling him to the bone. It was like the sun had been taken captive, barricaded behind a wall of thick grey clouds. Mist seemed to attach itself to everything, the rocks, the ocean, even Grey's drenched clothes. Though he had hoped the rain would abate, instead it howled with laughter and fell harder, icy needles pricking his cheeks and the back of his neck. Surprisingly, he missed scrubbing the decks of the Jewel under the heat of the blazing sun. He couldn't walk quite right, one of his legs hitching with every step. Of course, like every other lad growing up in the Western Kingdom, he'd heard the ghost stories about this place, but right now, with his amputated hand and lurching limp, he was the only undead creature staggering across the barren landscape. The thought made him laugh, and for a moment he howled along with the wind, feeling more alive than he'd ever felt in his life. He wondered whether he'd taken a hit to the head, sending him spiraling into madness. That thought made him laugh, too. Reaching across his body, he pinched himself, trying to get control. Think. He had to think. He'd had a small amount of food and water, but both were lost when his boat was swept away. Water likely wouldn't be a problem, given the incessant rainfall. Food, on the other hand. He spun in a circle, seeing nothing but bare, black rocks, towering cliffs, and an endless ocean full of whitecaps. There! He might have screamed the word, but if he did, the wind stole his voice again. A light flickered through the mist, elevated from his current position. Atop the cliffs? Or is it a star? He wondered. No. Despite how grey everything was, it was still daytime. There would be no stars. He saw it again, a sparkle of light fighting through the storm. Someone else was on the island, too. Everyone had a different opinion as to what exactly the Dead Isles were haunted by. Some said it was where children went if they died, transforming into something evil, feasting on the flesh of wayward travellers that were shipwrecked on the island's shores. Others believed it was the tip of the first heaven, the place where wrath banished the very worst souls, sticking from the ocean as a warning to all those who would sin. There were even those who claimed the isles themselves were alive, part of a monstrous demon whose hunger was never satisfied, devouring those who were unlucky enough to step foot on its rocky skin. To Grey, however, it was just a damn dismal place. He hated the thought that Shay might be here, shivering like him. He hadn't even seen a single ghost. He hadn't seen anything save for that light, which seemed to get further and further away with each step. Because of this, his initial excitement had faded into the mist, and weariness and depression began to gnaw on his bones like a pair of starving hounds. But still, he soldiered on, grunting and cursing as he clambered over rough, jagged boulders, making his way toward the base of the cliffs, where he hoped to find something. Best-case scenario would be a set of gently winding stairs that he could take to the top. Even a rope would do. However, when he finally reached the cliffs, what he found made him sink to the ground and close his eyes. A smooth, sheer rock face stared down at him, grinning a devil's grin. Grey let himself wallow for a few minutes. After all, he'd earned it. He didn't cry. The last thing he wanted on his face was more salt water. But he groaned, an audible representation of all his frustration and the aches and pains thrumming through his body. Then he slapped himself on the cheek, hard enough to snap himself out of his temporary misery. He rose to his feet and continued on, skirting the edge of the unclimbable cliffs. "There is a light up there somewhere," he reminded himself, "which means someone climbed it. If they did it, so can I. And I will." He kept repeating those words. "I will, I will, I will," over and over in his head, which kept his feet moving one after the other. Eventually, as he made his way around to the perpendicular side of the cliffs, the landscape changed slightly. The face of the cliff tilted, like the back of a giant as he craned his neck to stare at the sky. Further along still, he found a trail of sorts. It was rough, not paved exactly, but hewn into the rocks themselves, switching back and forth up the side of the cliffs. He pounded his chest with his stump, opening his mouth to drink the rain. It would be a long trek to the top, and he would need to stay hydrated. And then he started to climb. Grey felt like a drunk as he staggered onto the top of the cliffs. His legs were jelly, wobbling beneath him. Everything spun with walls of black, grey, and white, and orange. The light. It was at the top of a craggy hill, standing before a stone structure. A torch of some kind, beckoning him. He paused, taking a moment to steady himself, to drink more rain. He desperately wanted to sit down, better yet, to lie down and sleep. But he resisted the urge. He knew if he went down, he might not have the energy to get up again. He walked on, reeling in the light with each step, watching it grow bigger and brighter in his field of vision, vibrant against the wall of grey. The light marked the door to the structure, a rusty iron slab with a huge metal hoop for a doorknob. The building was constructed of enormous stone blocks, each so large it would take 100 men on ropes to lift it. Grey couldn't imagine this barren place teeming with enough men to build this structure. Unless, of course, some of the stories were true, and it was built by the undead, using supernatural powers. He laughed away the thought, but then went silent when the doors began to groan. As fast as he could with his injured leg, he hustled around the corner of the building and pressed his back to the wall, breathing. Breathing and listening. The rain fell in a sheet before him, but not hitting him because he was now under an overhang provided by long, cut stones that formed a roof of sorts. Rainwater dripped from his clothing, from his ears, from the tip of his nose, from his fingertips, and from the soaked bandages wrapped around his stump. With a final creak, the door slammed open. And then, silence. Grey pursed his lips, waiting for a sound, anything to give him an idea of who or what had opened the door. But there was nothing, just the whistle of wind over the cliffs and the drum of rain on the rocks. He envisioned himself sticking his head out and having it separated from his neck by a ghostly scythe. He swallowed the thought down, steeled his nerves, and peered around the corner. Even through the mist, the color of the two figures' robes was unmistakable. Red. "Holy eyes of wrath! I've found them!" Grey thought, ducking back behind the corner. The holy warriors were just standing there, like sentinels, staring out into the storm, saying nothing. He held his breath and peeked out once more. The Furia were gone. Frowning, Grey stepped out, peering further along the wall until he could see the door, which still stood open. A sound from behind caught his attention, and he spun around. A powerful fist smashed into his head, knocking him backwards, sending him rolling arse over tea kettle down the rocky incline. He came to a stop when the back of his head collided with a medium-sized stone. Stars flashed across his eyes, though his eyelids were closed, fading to blackness and then worse. Oblivion. A scream as bright as a flame jarred Grey awake. He coughed, rolling to the side and spewing up a bitter mixture of seawater and his breakfast from that morning on the jewel. A soft yellow light illuminated the pool of vomit below him. He hung off the edge of a makeshift bed, stacked stones covered by a thin mattress. "Where am I?" The question rolled and tossed through his mind, like a ship lost at sea. The answer broke through the waves in a rush. The Dead Isles, the cliffs, the Furia. Captured. And the scream he heard was familiar. Like family familiar.
"Shay!"
"No!"
he breathed, struggling against the ropes that he could now feel biting into his ankles and wrist, secured to iron stakes pounded into the stone walls. Only his stump remained free, wriggling like a worm. Some good that would do him.
"Shay!"
he shouted. But he was answered only by another scream. He knew he was only alive because the Furia wanted answers. They might remember him, and if so, they'd probably kill him eventually. Even if they didn't remember him, they'd want to know who he was and why he was there. And then they'd likely kill him. Either way, he was up a rutting creek without even a single god's damn paddle.
"Ah!"
he roared in frustration, pulling against his tethers until they tore into his skin, rubbing him raw and letting the warmth of blood flow freely down his arm and legs. A door creaked open, a backlit shadow filling the entrance to whatever chamber he was being held in.
"I want to see my sister,"
he demanded.
"Grey Arris,"
the woman said, stepping into the light.
"Or do you still prefer your ridiculous alias, Grease Jolly?"
He instantly knew her, that cold, hard expression, those dark, uncaring eyes, the long, fiery hair. The woman who had cut off his hand. One of the three. A Fury. Instinctively, he wanted to shrink away from her, but his ropes held him fast.
"Where's she?" he managed to whimper. "Who?"
The fear was swiftly replaced with anger, roiling through him like a fireball, spewing from his mouth like dragon's breath.
"My God's damn sister, you evil witch! If you've so much as laid a single finger on her, I swear I will—"
"Stop, child," the fury said. Grey stopped, her words like steel blades compared to his, which were naught but wooden play swords.
"You are bound and helpless, and your threats are just threats. And there is only one god, Roth. So don't profane him with Southron superstitions."
Grey took a deep breath, calming himself. She was right. Hurling meaningless threats was pointless and wouldn't help him or Shay.
"Is she alive?"
he asked, hating the submission in his voice, the deep and unassailable fear.
"Yes, Shay is alive. I heard her scream."
She made no attempt to deny it.
"You did."
"Why?"
"My sister burned your sister's skin with a hot knife,"
the fury answered.
"What?"
Cold rage pulsed back to the surface, and Grey wanted to scream to release it.
"Shay! Can you hear me?"
"Grey?"
a voice called out. It sounded weak, trembling, like a raindrop clutching the edge of a leaf, afraid to fall.
"We've been working very hard to uncover your sister's secrets, but now we're running out of time. All we have left are drastic measures."
"What secrets?"
Grey said. They already knew she was marked. They already knew she'd been hiding it her whole life, that he'd been helping her. Neither of them had anything left to hide.
"Why, her power, of course, foolish boy. This will all go better and will be less painful for both of you, if you just tell me. Your sister has been unwilling so far."
Grey gritted his teeth, growling his words between them.
"That's because she doesn't know, and neither do I."
The fury tapped her teeth with long red fingernails.
"Could she have been telling the truth?"
Another scream rent the air and tore at Grey's ears.
"Stop it!"
Tears were pricking at his eyes now, blurring his vision. He couldn't move, couldn't act, could only beg.
"Please! Please! I'd do anything!"
"Sister!"
the fury shouted. The scream fell away, until Grey could only make out a soft whimper. Footsteps approached, and then the other fury entered, standing beside her sister.
"You called?"
Though her face was as harsh as her sister's, the second fury had thinner, sharper eyebrows, and fierce green eyes that seemed to burn.
"I don't think they know,"
the first fury said. The second fury touched the collar of her crimson robe thoughtfully.
"That complicates things. But we should make certain they're not lying."
"How?"
the first fury asked. The second fury nodded at Grey.
"By killing him in front of his sister."
28. The Southern Empire. The Skara Desert. Raven Sands.
"We should stop and make camp," Raven said. Fire's shadowy form was backlit by the green moon goddess Luahi, who had risen from the west. "We ride on," she said, refusing to meet her sister's eyes. Raven felt like leaping from Ichnon and tackling her sister, using force to persuade her where reason had failed half a dozen times already. Instead, she gritted her teeth and tried again. "Even if the riders reach Kesh tonight, those on foot have fallen well behind. We need to stay together." Fire wheeled her guanac around.
"This is no debate,"
she snarled.
Her reptilian steed hissed its agreement. Raven watched her sister ride ahead once more, her entire body blazing with unburning flames. All tenderness they'd shared on this journey thus far seemed consumed by the blaze. Goggin pulled up beside her.
"Long have the Guanero served a Sands Empress," he said. "Do not treat us with child gloves."
And then he, too, rode on. Raven sighed. She knew the man was right. At the heart of it, she wasn't worried about the Guanero or the bedraggled army marching behind them. She was worried about her sister. Ahead of her, Goggin let out a whoop. Fearing he'd been bitten by something poisonous, she charged after him, plunging with reckless speed into a trough, and then pushing her guanac to his limits up the next rise. There Goggin stood, a mountain of muscle and flesh against the silver sky. A smile as broad as the horizon was painted on his round face as he stared into the distance. Raven followed his gaze to where lights twinkled like fallen stars on the desert sand. Shadows of palm trees rose up amongst the lights, their large fronds shifting in the wind. They'd reached the oasis. They'd reached Kesh. Despite the hour, Kesh was alive with activity. According to Goggin, who claimed to have visited the desert city more times than he could count with his boots off, Kesh lived in the night and dozed in the day. Grudgingly, Raven had to admit that Fire had timed their arrival perfectly. A throng of men wearing brightly coloured frocks and baggy pants greeted them where the dunes met a thatch of thick foliage. One of them stepped forward and extended a hand to help Fire down from her mount. His arms jingled with brass bracelets as he lifted them.
"It is an honour to meet Empress Fire," he said.
Motioning to Raven, he added,
"And the first daughter, too. The hospitality of Kesh is at your disposal."
At the entrance to the city, there were a dozen torches planted in the sand, blazing happily. A line of torches led the way into a broad space filled with thatched huts and seating areas placed strategically under copses of palm trees. Ignoring the man's offered hand, Fire leapt down, landing on her feet with a thud. Her guanac snapped its jaws at the poor fellow, who hopped back, chuckling.
"Your beast is lively, even after a long day's trek."
"You are?" Fire said.
"Guta," the man said,
removing a plush purple hat with no brim and a tall dome.
"At your service."
He bowed with a broad flourish, sweeping his hat low all the way to the sand. "Thank you," Fire said. "You received my streams?"
"Two of them."
"I sent six."
"Yes, well, even water communications are confounded by the shifting sands and heat of the Skara. Two of six is considered quite successful."
Raven dismounted beside her sister. "Then you are aware of our numbers?"
3,000, the man said,
peering into the night as if counting their train. Goggin and his guanero pulled to a stop, sliding off their mounts. The brightly clothed men descended on the animals, steering them over to long water basins. Soon the beasts were drinking, while the men rubbed the sand from their rough skin with wet towels. Goggin stomped forward.
"I trust you have, Simpra," he asked. "It flows like water,"
Guta said. Here in the desert, where water was scarce, Raven wasn't sure what that meant exactly.
"Good. Bring 10 barrels and—"
He sniffed the air.
"Is that smoked paizan I smell?"
Guta grinned.
"You have a good nose." "I have a good stomach," Goggin said,
rubbing his belly and licking his lips. Guta chuckled.
"Fanes may have the largest of the snakes, but the Skara's brown paizans are easier to kill and have flesh sweet enough for the palate of the gods." "No gods here," Goggin said. "But we'll eat the god food just the same. Now show us to the Simpra."
"No," Fire said. Goggin frowned.
"Should we wait for the rest of the army? They are well behind."
"No," Fire said again. "We will eat and drink water. No Simpra. We need our wits about us."
"No disrespect," Goggin said. "But we rode hard today, and those on foot did too. They'll expect a reward. And we have 3 days of rest in Kesh before we continue on, so—"
"One day," Fire said. "We have 1 day." Raven interjected herself into the conversation. "We agreed on 3 days at the War Council," she said. "The army needs it. We need it. You need it," she didn't say. "We lost 2 days on the bridge. We're going to make up for that by not tarrying here."
"We have food and drink for 3 days for your entire force," Guta said.
Even his smile was beginning to falter as the mood changed.
"And I thank you for that," Fire said. "We will take as much as we can carry when we depart. The rest you can give to other travellers."
"Fire," Raven started to say, but stopped when her sister shot a dark look in her direction. Goggin turned to his men.
"You heard the Empress. We have one day. Let's make the most of it. And I don't want to catch any of you so much as sniffing the Simpra. We need to save it for the return trip, after we're victorious at the gates."
Raven looked to see if her sister appreciated the response from her war leader, but she was already gone, following Guta toward one of the sitting areas. Goggin hadn't exaggerated. Kesh was a magical place, full of brightly coloured tents, aromatic smells, festival music, and all the water you could drink. Raven took advantage, emptying four wooden cups before tucking into the generous slab of brown pison that Guta served to her personally. Fire was already halfway finished with her mate, while Goggin was on to a second helping. The large man seemed determined to consume a full 3 days' worth of food in a single night. Raven sighed as she bit into the flesh, which was cooked to perfection. The typically rubbery meat was tender and flaky now, having been spiced and then cooked underground on a bed of palm fronds set over a layer of hot coals. The whole was then covered with more palm fronds until the meat had been infused with the flavour of smoke. It practically melted in her mouth. "Thank you," she said to Guta, who never seemed to stop moving, directing a dozen dark-eyed women hither and thither. The women were also garbed in bright uniforms, dresses formed of red, purple, yellow, and blue squares sewn together. All of Guta's men and women worked seamlessly together, performing their varied tasks with efficiency. The famed hospitality of Kesh was more than living up to its reputation. They sat on plush, tasseled red, yellow, and green cushions, piled atop long wooden benches, flanked by huge tables teeming with food and water. As foot soldiers continued to arrive, they were directed to cushions placed on the ground next to huge, colourful blankets set with more food and drink. Nearly the entire space was full already, and soldiers kept coming. Amidst the crowd, six men played an assortment of instruments: guanac skin drums, bone pipes, and a stringed instrument called a banjejo. Goggin tossed down what was left of his meat and leapt to his feet, grabbing one of the servers and twirling her around, dodging traffic. Though at first she looked shocked, the woman recovered quickly, throwing herself into a traditional desert dance known as the whip, a name Raven had always appreciated. Others joined her, the women using their long, dark, braided hair like whips, flinging them around and warding off their attackers, the guanero. Raven laughed at the spectacle, and she even caught a smirk from Fire, whose stony facade slowly crumbled amongst the festive atmosphere. Her sister's eyes met hers, but then slipped away, back to the dancers and musicians. Raven considered sliding across the bench to speak with her, but decided against it. Perhaps Fire needed space. The heat and toils of the day had worn on them both. Instead, she leaned back and watched the palms rustle softly overhead, blanketed by a sea of stars twinkling green, red, gold. Several of the red stars coursed across the sky while the green gods seemed to explode one by one. Luahi, the moon goddess, had been joined by her brother Ruaho, the moon god, who'd risen from the east. Luahi was nearly full, a brilliant green orb, while Ruaho was just a red sliver, like a crimson smile. Though Luahi finished her cycle from full to sliver in a mere 28 days, her brother was almost twice slower, taking 52 days to accomplish the same feat. Men, she thought, always a bit behind. The sibling moons' paths approached each other now, but Raven knew they wouldn't cross, not tonight. The brother and sister only met once a year, on an auspicious night, when they were both full at the same time, and they were still months away from joining hands in the sky. Raven wondered whether she and Fire's relationship was taking a similar path. When she tried to catch Fire's gaze again, her sister was gone, having snuck away, their paths missing once more. Though she hadn't gone to bed until daybreak, Raven awoke at midday feeling refreshed.
The day was hot, but she wasn't sweating. A cool breeze wafted through the palms that shaded her. Additionally, the large blankets that had been used to serve dinner to the masses had been affixed to poles, providing draping canopies for every single soldier. Raven was shocked to find Guta already up, too, moving amongst a group of early risers, serving them breakfast. The tireless man had been awake when Raven retired for the night, and it appeared he didn't have need of sleep. He seemed to be running things on his own, because Raven spotted his brightly clad women and men sleeping amongst the soldiers. Goggin had his arm draped around one of the women, the dark-eyed beauty he'd initially danced with, her head cradled in the crook of his shoulder. The sight made Raven laugh. The sound caught Guta's attention, and he beckoned her over, setting a place for her at the table, and filling it with a plate of 2 hard-boiled eggs, spiced pison links, and 1/2 a pineapple, sliced down the middle. "Thank you," she said. "I trust you have been compensated already." His large smile grew even bigger.
"Yes, the Empress is most generous."
Raven's own smile faded at the mention of her sister. "I apologize for her conduct last night." Guta waved it away like he was swatting a fly.
"She has much weight on her mind."
"All the same, we appreciate your kindness." He swept his hands across the oasis with a grand gesture.
"This is what I live for."
He flashed his teeth. Raven laughed. "How did you get into the oasis business?"
"I grew up in the desert," he said. "You could say I am at home amongst the dunes. Kesh has been managed by my family for many generations. My uncle was the last, and he had no children, so it fell to me after he was taken by the sand."
"Well, I'd say you were born to do this." The compliment seemed to please the small man greatly, his eyes lighting up. He rushed off, calling over his shoulder,
"I'll bring more eggs."
Raven shook her head. She was already over full. She slipped away from the table and sought to locate her sister, who was likely asleep in one of the thatched huts. No luck. Fire wasn't amongst the sleeping forms in the makeshift structures. She spotted Guta again and inquired about the Empress.
"She went to see to the Guanik," he said.
Raven made her way toward where the Guanik were tethered to metal plugs pounded into the ground. Fire was stroking her Guanik's head, feeding it strips of smoked snake meat. "Sarai shines on you this day," Raven said, using the formal morning greeting. Without turning, Fire said, "Until Luahi and Ruaho meet in the sky." Raven approached her own Guanik, and Iknon nuzzled against her hand, searching it for a treat. She'd saved an egg for him, which he swallowed down, shell and all. Though the Guanik were fierce beasts in battle, they were as docile as lambs when given a good scratching and an egg or two.
"Fire, I'm sorry—" "No," Fire said, cutting her off. "It is I who am sorry, sister."
Raven was taken aback by her sister's apology, as unexpected as it was.
"For what?" "I have been unreasonable. It's just ever since Marta, I've felt uneasy."
"I know. I feel the same."
"No,"
Fire said.
"I don't think you do. I feel as if an Arrak is nipping at my heels, and if I don't keep moving, it will eat me alive."
"Well, considering what you did to the last Arrak you faced, I don't think you have too much to worry about." She had intended it as a joke, but Fire only shook her head. Raven approached her sister, whose arms were hanging limply at her sides. There was no fight in them, not now.
"I don't understand what you mean."
Fire shook her head in frustration.
"Last night felt too happy. I couldn't handle it. This world is broken. Our family, broken. Our kingdom, broken. We shouldn't be laughing. We shouldn't be dancing. We should be fighting."
Raven shook her head.
"No, you're wrong. If we can't laugh, if we can't dance, if we can't be happy, then what are we fighting for? For the chance to be happy. For a people who've never been given that chance. For a future."
"Whisper?"
"Not only her, but yes.
Whisper is as soft as a flower petal. She wasn't made for this world. She's not like us."
Though Raven was surprised that Fire placed them in the same category, it made her feel warm inside. Fire continued,
"She deserves a place where she can be safe, a life where she doesn't have to be scared about losing the people she loves." "I know. I agree. That's what we're trying to do. But it's not just her that deserves such a world."
Fire frowned.
"I know that. Our people deserve that. Fata's slaves deserve that. You deserve that."
Fire looked away.
"I am a weapon. Nothing more, nothing less. You're wrong. You're my sister. You're caring, you're kind, you're strong. Yes, you're a weapon, but you are so much more." "You think I'm kind?"
Fire almost laughed.
"Well, not all the time, but sometimes. Now you are. The soldiers will trust you when you're fierce, but they'll follow you when you're kind. If you're trying to soften me up so I'll change my mind, it won't work."
Raven laughed.
"I know. I'm not. We ride out first thing tomorrow, as you have commanded. I respect your decision."
Fire placed a hand on Raven's shoulder.
"And I respect your advice. We shall stay in Kesh 2 days. It's the best I can do."
Raven blinked back the tears threatening to spill from her eyes as she grabbed her sister's hand.
"It is good enough."
There was a murmur of excitement through the camp when Fire made the announcement that they were staying another day. Guta smiled even more, until Raven was certain his face had gotten stuck that way. Then again, she was smiling quite a lot, too. Not only had the wall around her sister seemed to have come down, but she'd finally listened to something Raven had said. The words her martyr had taught them as children whispered in her mind.
"Together we are the rock that cannot be broken."
She also remembered how sad her mother always seemed when someone mentioned her own sister, Viper. She wondered whether her mother had felt broken when Viper had left for Zoon. If so, the thought made Raven unbearably sad.
"I thought this was what you wanted,"
Fire said, startling her.
"Oh, it is. I was just..."
"What?"
"You looked on the verge of tears." "I was thinking of Marta."
Fire said,
"Close your eyes."
"What?"
"Close your eyes." "Fire, I don't know what I command you as your empress." "I believe that's called frivolous use of power,"
Raven said, but she closed her eyes.
"See her face. See her hair, like Sarai's golden ropes. That's Whisper's beauty. See her corded muscles, her stern jaw. That's me. Can you see her?"
Raven could see her mother in her mind so clearly, it was like she'd never left.
"I see her. Do you see yourself?"
Raven tried to, but she couldn't. She shook her head.
"See her eyes, beaded obsidian. She is fearless. She is caring. She is intelligent."
Raven saw her mother's eyes. Yes, she was all of those things.
"I see them. Her eyes are yours,"
Fire said.
"She is in us,"
Fire said.
"All of us. And she is with us."
Raven could see it now. When she opened her eyes, her sister had moved off to speak to Goggin and the Guanero, her high laughter joining the sound of music playing. That night, Raven was jarred from sleep by a scraping sound. She blinked quickly, trying to make sense of where she was and what she'd heard. The underside of a thatched roof stared down at her, visible only because of a painted swathe of green moonlight cascading through the entrance to the hut she slept in. Nearby, Fire breathed deeply, fast asleep. They were the only ones in the hut, the rest of the Guanero choosing to pass the night under the stars, under watchful eyes of the moon god and goddess. Except there was someone else. A shadow clinging to the wall, moving, creeping, sliding. Something glinted in the moonlight, the edge of a blade. Raven moved like a striking scorpion, yelling out as she lunged across the small space. The knife came down, but she managed to grab the arm of the attacker, stopping the blade a mere finger breadth from Fire's face.
Her sister's eyes flashed open, her mouth opening in horror at seeing a knife tip hovering overhead. The attacker grunted, trying to force it down. Raven pushed back, but the blade dipped lower wildly, just missing fire as she twisted her head to the side. Raven strained against the force, which then toppled over, somersaulting away and crashing into the side of the hut. Raven moved to throw herself at the would-be assassin once more, but Fire held her back.
Fire, we have to—
Shh!
He's gone, sister. You saved me.
Raven searched her sister's face in the moonlight. Past her, the shadowy figure let out a final groan and then went still. Fire released her, and she pushed past, crouching down warily. A blade protruded from the attacker's chest, right over the heart. Fire's sword. She must have been sleeping with it on hand. Raven grabbed the attacker's feet and dragged the body into the moonlight. When she saw who it was, she inhaled sharply. It wasn't a man. One of Guta's dark-eyed beauties. The one Goggin had danced with on the first night, cradling her head as they slept.
29. The Southern Empire, Fanes, War City of Susa. The Beggar. Bane touched the beggar's gloved hand, and their dark world vanished, only to be replaced by another world, full of leather plate and steel sword, roasting meat, and platoons of marching soldiers.
"Where are we?"
the beggar asked. They were nestled in a dark alleyway, out of sight for the moment.
"Susa,"
Bane said, stepping into the light, his bald head gleaming in the sun. Like this, amongst so many people, the boy looked utterly small and powerless. Having slept for almost 4 days and nights in a row, Bane now looked wide-eyed and ready for whatever was to come.
Fanes?
The beggar remembered what Bane had said to him a few nights ago, how they were going to infect an army near the Southron Gates. Were these marching soldiers the army he meant? The beggar had never been outside of Calypso before, though Susa didn't seem that different at first glance. Soldiers had often marched through his home city, too, although they wore different armor and often rode Guanic. The buildings here were constructed of a different kind of stone, grey granite rather than beige sandstone, but that was a minor difference. The largest difference, however, was the noise. Calypso had sometimes been called the Silent City for a reason. The people spoke in hushed tones, rarely raising their voices to a shout, except in the grand arena or fighting pits of Zune. In fact, the only other times he'd heard anyone shout were when he'd accidentally infected someone with the plague. He could still hear those sharp voices in his head, cutting deep inside his brain like knives. Slashing. Always slashing. Here in the Phoenician war city of Susa, everything seemed to make more noise. The horses stamped their feet as they marched. The soldiers' footsteps were like cannon blasts. The merchants selling roasted meat and tubs of freshly caught fish from the spear shouted their prices and haggled with customers. Even little girls squealed with delight as they played some sort of jumping game. The only ones who were silent were those bearing an identical mark around their necks, a black chain.
The slaves, the beggar realized.
People in Calypso often talked about the plight of the red-skinned Terran slaves, but until seeing them in the flesh, he'd never really thought about it. They moved silently throughout the city, performing various tasks, rarely speaking unless they were issued a command, in which case they would respond, "Yes, master."
"They're like me," he said aloud,
"a slave to their marks, half dead already."
"No,"
Bane said, shaking his head.
"You have power. They have nothing."
The beggar had never thought of his tattooia as a mark of power, only as a curse. Bane led him through the heart of the bustling war city, ignoring the vendors as they shouted offers at them. Twice the beggar was bumped into by passers-by in the crowd, but both times he was careful not to let any of his skin make direct contact with their skin. Still, he felt a jolt of fear each time. After the second time, Bane squinted at him and said,
"You fear your power. Truly."
There was only one answer, although giving it to his only friend made him feel ashamed.
"Yes,"
Heat rose to his cheeks. "You need not be embarrassed. I fear mine, too."
And then Bane turned away and continued through the crowd, cutting a zigzagging course. The beggar was surprised. Ever since he'd come into contact with the boy, Bane had acted so decisively, without fear. If he really feared his own power, he hid it well. Tripping over his own feet, he stumbled to catch up to his friend before he lost him in the crowd. However, when the beggar emerged from a thick patch of people, he found Bane standing alone, without a small gate set in a tall, curving wall that surrounded the city. The beggar reached his side and followed his gaze to a wall 10 times larger than the one protecting Susa, so vast that it might have been a mountain had it not been constructed of enormous stone blocks. The Southron Gates. Everyone in Calypso knew of them, but few had seen them. Unless you were Phoenician, going anywhere near the famed gates would generally get you killed. And yet here they were, a northerner and a Calypsian, standing within marching distance of the gateway to the west. The beggar turned back to look through the entrance into the city, watching the soldiers marching hither and thither.
"Is that the army you want me to infect?" he asked.
Bane didn't answer for a long time, peering at the wall under the shade provided by his cupped hand.
"Stay here," he said. "Consider what you want to do. You are no slave, and I am not your master. I am your brother, your friend. Yes, this is Vinhosa's army, and they reap death everywhere they go."
"But if I infect them, won't everyone in the city die? The plague spreads like wildfire, and the Phoenicians are ill-equipped to quarantine those who fall ill."
"Many must die before we can have peace," was Bane's only response. And then he vanished.
Bane didn't return for 3 long days. The beggar spent them staring at the people in Susa, studying them. He watched horrors being committed. A slave beaten to within an inch of his life simply because he didn't complete a task fast enough. And yet he also saw great love exhibited. A little girl, the daughter of one of the soldiers, giving her father a flower. He swung her around and around as she laughed.
"Many must die before we can have peace."
Was Bane right? Would infecting this slave city offer peace to the 4 kingdoms?
"Is that my true purpose? The reason I was given this cursed tattoo by the gods or whomever?"
The more the beggar watched the Susians, the more confused he became, the more torn in half. When Bane finally returned, looking troubled and weary, the beggar said,
"I have made no decision."
"You will," Bane said. "You will."
30. The Southern Empire, the Red Rocks east of the Bloody Canyons. Jai Jaru. The day was garbed in sunshine, a seamless cape of light pulled tight across the harsh, barren landscape of shattered earth and broken rocks that dotted the terrain behind them. Off in the distance, Jai could just make out the enormous rotting carcass of what remained of the red pison, mostly its head, the only part that was unable to slither back underground. Vultures were already circling, diving and ripping off hunks of its flesh.
"We made it," Jai thought, shifting forward to gaze at the red rock spires ahead.
He was reclining on a makeshift gurney constructed from the wood of a gnarled old thatch whistle, which was known to be a strong and sturdy desert tree, despite its small stature. It was tied at the corners with rope harvested from the skin of the red pison, which, upon the snake's death, had lost its potency. Support branches ran along the bottom, also tied with the knotted ribbons of skin. For comfort, the skin beneath the pison's armor-like scales had been cut and layered. It was on this bed of drying skin that Jai now lounged. Of all people, it was Axa who carried him, gripping the front of the hammock with 2 hands. For the moment, his dusty old mirror was tucked somewhere in the folds of his sackcloth skirt. When it was time to depart, he'd stepped forward silently and picked up the gurney before anyone else could. Shanti had offered her horse to 2 people injured in the battle with the red pison, and now carried the opposite end,
watching Jai upside down. Everything hurt. Jai was bruised and scratched, like he'd been in a Phoenician street fight with a couple of thugs and a cat. His muscles